watch out, you better not fall.
Yes, stand by for Santa Claus, the Beacon Store, Santa's headquarters for Southwest Washington, presents the most important radio program of the year. Santa's very own, Santa's Magic Radio. We're going to take Santa's Magic Radio and talk to Santa at his North Pole headquarters. So, stand by for Santa Claus.
Now, any parents out there might have kids listening. We don't want to reveal any of Santa's secrets, so maybe put some earmuffs on. But we have the lost and found voice of a popular radio Santa from Southwest Washington from 70 years ago. Thanks to historian Felix Bunnell, who was brought to us by the King County Library System.
Yeah, well, first of all, let me be very clear. I believe in Santa Claus. And second, I'm a sucker for grown-ups who do things to make the lives of kids more magical. When I was a little kid in the 70s and I was in my doubting Santa phase, I'd hear those local and national media reports about NORAD tracking Santa's sleigh, and my doubts were permanently erased. So it turns out there were some grown-ups down in Lewis County who did a pretty special thing every year to help Santa. From the 1940s to sometime in the 1980s, for about 3 weeks before Christmas, radio station KELA in Centralia, Chehalis, would use a magic radio to connect with Santa Claus at the North Pole for 15 minutes each day. He'd read letters from local kids about what they wanted for Christmas, with help from his elf named Tommy Tinker. I stumbled across the story last week when my friend John Jenkins, who founded the incredible Spark Museum up in Bellingham, sent me a photo of a very old giant record in the museum collection. It's about 16 inches in diameter, requires a special record player, which I have, of course. The record label said it was from KELA, and it was marked Santa Claus Program 1950. My brother, who lives up north, grabbed it from Spark for me, and I digitized it during the Seahawk game on Sunday.
And we another letter in the same envelope from Carol Smoot of Onalaska. She wants a piano for Christmas. She's 9 1/2 years old. Mama would like a new stove for Christmas. And Daddy would like a new car because our car is falling to pieces. Well, now, isn't that a shame? My goodness, falling to pieces. We're going to have to bring some nuts and bolts and some haywire down there, and we'll put that car back together. And maybe, I don't know, these new cars are awful expensive.
Yeah, so I knew this recording was priceless and cool, but I didn't know any of the backstory. Fortunately, I posted a photo of the record label on Facebook, and I heard from a wonderful retired KELA radio guy named Steve Rickert, who grew up in Chehalis and now lives in Beaverton, Oregon. He worked at KELA for 42 years, beginning in 1971. He told me all about the long-running Letters to Santa program that he first heard as a kid back in the 50s. Steve Rickert said a local feed and seed store named Jimmy Vogel played Santa for KELA for about 30 years. He says the show was just plain magic.
Santa, actually, is reading the letter he got from you on his magic radio out of the North Pole with the wind blowing in the background. And Jimmy was good at ad-libbing things about the requests and throwing in little comments and endearing himself even more to the kids and by extension, the parents. And it was an opportunity for parents who wanted to extend the Christmas feeling that they had back when they were youngsters onto their children, and vicariously just wrapping themselves up in that whole feeling.
Steve says he's in touch with a lot of Chehalis Centralia old-timers on a Facebook page, and he says the Letters to Santa program comes up in online discussions every Christmas. You know, there's so many great moments in this 15-minute recording. You know, Santa, he reads full names and even the street addresses of some kids. He wouldn't do that nowadays. They're from places like Centralia, Chehalis, Napavine, and Onalaska. Now, we've posted the entire recording at My Northwest, and my hope is that it will get shared far and wide, and maybe some of the kids mentioned can be tracked down. I'd love to hear memories from someone who actually had their letter read aloud on KELA, maybe even on this recording. Now, here's one of my favorite clips, which mentions the whereabouts of an older brother.
And here's a nice letter from, let's see, this is from Chehalis or Centralia. It's from Jim Hudson. He says he wants a sailboat, a Red Ryder BB gun, a basketball, and he says bring my big brother Eugene something too. I think he might be
heavy slowing, but
he is in Korea, and please bring something for my two big sisters, Edna and Temple, and maybe some perfume or hair lotion. And I know you're busy. I hope you'll find time to come by my house. He's 7 years old.
Yeah, so the Korean War had just begun that summer of 1950. So I'd love to know what happened to Eugene Hudson, who was off of the Korean War and coming home to Chehalis or Centralia. And did you catch that part about the Red Ryder BB gun?
Yeah,
that's just like Ralphie in A Christmas Story,
which
is right from this very same era, this post-World War II era. Now, here's a short clip that I like because it mentions some specific treats that are going to be left out for Santa.
He says, I want a fire engine, a sled, a holster set with two guns, and the guns in it. And I hope you don't get too tired this Christmas. I'll leave some hot coffee and donuts for you.
Now, Steve Rickert told me one more anecdote about Jimmy Vogel and the Santa Show. It seems that in the early years, there wasn't an auxiliary studio for Santa to broadcast from. So You know, radio is notoriously an inventive and cheap industry, and also somewhat mischievous, too.
Efficient, so they, we like to call
yeah,
it.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. It's just, it's we work on the fly. So they ran a microphone cable from the main studio down the hall to the men's room. And Santa did the whole show while sitting on a white porcelain throne. And so perhaps what happened next was inevitable.
Someone has a prank, you know, while the show was on the air, went in there and pushed down the flush handle on the toilet. And he ad-libbed his way through it. Oh, the wind is kicking up a storm here up at the North Pole.
Now, Jimmy Vogel, it sounds like he was quite a character. He didn't have any kids or anything. He might have had some nieces and nephews who might still be around. He passed away in 1979. He ran this thing called Pioneer Feed and Seed, which is, the business is still there. It's called something else now, but it's still in the original location. And he hosted a garden show every week on KLA, but he just did this Santa Claus thing every year for some reason. And we don't know exactly it started or how it came about, but it seems like it was from sometime after World War II until Jimmy passed away. And then they had another person come in and take over and do it for a few years into the early 1980s. And I had never heard of this before, but I've heard from several people now down in this area around Centralia, Chehalis. Yeah. And this was a thing. This was something that everybody would look forward to. You drop your letter off at the Beacon store, which is, I don't think they're around anymore. But then ultimately the Yardbirds started sponsoring it. Newspaper ads with a box where you could drop your letter off for Santa. So it's just...
It's remarkable that was saved.
It's just totally random. And I don't know exactly how John Jenkins got his hands on it, but you know, he's been sending me pictures of these discs that he's trying to find a home for, and I'm working with some museums I know down here. And it's just this amazing thing. Christmas and radio, I wrote about this before, Christmas and radio grew up together in the 20th century. There's so many radio firsts and magical things happened on Christmas around radio because people were home and they were sitting around with nothing to do and there was so much content available. And it's just the magic of the magical part of Christmas, the magical part of radio, it comes together on Christmas. And it just makes the back of my neck tingle just thinking about it. Oh, one thing, I asked Steve Rickert, did Jimmy Vogel dress up like Santa while he was doing the show? And I don't want to ruin the surprise, but no, he didn't dress up like Santa. It's all theater of the mind. So it's just an awesome thing. And we have that whole recording at My Northwest. And I would love people to play that, share it, listen to it. And if you've come across or know anybody who's on that recording, get in touch with me. My email address is there. And it's just my favorite story of the year so far.
Yeah. We used to, when I was doing my talk show in the early days, Pam Sowers, my producer, remembered the Christmas celebrations at, I think it was Steel Lake, and she created this whole fictitious world.
Oh, wow.
Where we did a radio Christmas party with, you know, sounds and music and dances and all that. And you're right. There's something about the holiday. And it's because, Felix, there's really no news going on.
Exactly.
And so, you know, you got to fill the time somehow. And why not have fun doing it? And you're right. There's a rich history of a Christmas broadcast along those lines. Felix Bonnell is brought to us each week by the King County Library System. You can find his features at mynorthwest.com. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, Dave.
Choke points.
Let's go.
A bonus Wednesday choke point brought to you by Online Trading Academy. It will be another rough morning through Kenmore and the northeast corner of Lake Washington. The 68th Avenue Bridge is out of commission for a second day, and Chris is going to tell us why.
Well, first of all, for those of you that aren't familiar with this small bridge, it's 68th Avenue connects the north end of Juanita with Kenmore and to Highway 522. As we found out watching yesterday's morning commute, a lot of people use this connection to avoid 522 and avoid getting on 405 to make their way into Kirkland. About 26,000 vehicles a day use this bridge every day. And what we saw yesterday was 522 eastbound with a 3-mile backup for several hours. There were major delays on Simmons Road Northeast and 100 Northeast, and it's going to be like that again today because the bridge is out again today. And it's not the bridge, it's actually the access to the bridge. So here's what happened. The North Shore Utility District is moving the sewer lines just south of the bridge span. It didn't want to cut open the road because that would have forced it to shut down 68th Avenue. So Utility District Engineer Dave Kaiser told me that they decided to tunnel under the road and...
We overmined is the term we would use. We took out more material than we intended to, and you know, the resulting void works its way up to the surface and creates a sinkhole.
In case you couldn't hear that through, it was kind of a scratchy cell phone there. He said they overmined. They took out more than they were expecting. Yeah. And so that opened up a void of about 20 feet by 20 feet and 6 feet deep under 68th Avenue, but it didn't open up the road above.
The roadway bridged the void, and it created a little depression in the roadway, and part of the shoulder fell in. But so we didn't actually get a gaping open hole.
And they've been working from above for the last 36 hours to fill in that void and get this bridge reopened.
Core drilling holes in through the surface of the roadway to allow the contractor to pour CDF, which is a flowable concrete material, through the top of the road into the void, fill the void.
So they're dumping concrete in there to try to shore up that hole, and then, of course, they're going to have to do some road repair work before they can reopen 68th Avenue and reconnect Kenmore with North Juanita and Finn Hill. The North Shore Utility District is moving the sewer line in preparation for next year's project to replace the 68th Avenue Bridge, which has been weight restricted for years because it is in bad shape. There are currently two spans there across the Sammamish River, one in each direction. It's the southbound bridge, the original span, which was built in the 1930s, that is going to be replaced. So I'm going to be keeping a very close eye on that corner of Lake Washington this morning to see if we have a similar repeat to what we saw yesterday. I'm already seeing a little bit more action on 100th right now, heading southbound towards the Juanita area. But yeah, we'll be watching this one. Just one of those unexpected things that happened with construction work.
Aren't you supposed to call 811 before you dig?
Well, they did. Oh. They did, but they took out, as the engineer matter-of-factly told me, Dave told me, They overmined. They took out too much. So
yeah, there you go. We've had quite a few sexual assault allegations this year that brought down some pretty prominent men. Sometimes those accusations are false. It was a false rape allegation that nearly cost the Bellevue police chief his job, and two other cops left the department over similar accusations made by the same woman. Now, King County prosecutors have filed several charges against the Issaquah woman behind what they call a sophisticated ruse that was deliberately targeting police. Cat Radio's Hannah Scott is here. So what was going on?
This has gone on 4 months. So essentially, this woman, a 45-year-old woman from Issaquah, her name is Aiden Schneider, she had had a relationship with at least one Bellevue police officer who she had met online through a Craigslist ad, and I believe another. That had been going on for months. Yesterday, she was charged for making up rape claims against Chief Milette, and as well as accusations against one of those officers she met online, John Kivlin. That was not a rape allegation, I want to point out. There was domestic violence things going on in that allegation. She's also charged because of fabricating evidence against both men. Now she's facing four separate charges for the bogus claims. She had also accused a third Bellevue cop of rape, allegations that were investigated earlier this year but never resulted in any charges against him. That officer and Kivlin both met the woman online and have both since left the department. Then in late July, when the allegations against those two officers were being investigated, Schneider told Bothell police that Chief Milette had raped her at his rental home after the two met on a fetish website for people looking for rough sex. Milette was immediately placed on leave and at the time was shocked by the accusations.
I'm trying to figure out how this could have happened because I have no connection to this individual. I've never met her. Never been around her, never spoken with her. And so I was anxious to find out more information.
Milette remained on leave for nearly 3 months as the investigation into him continued. And separately, King County was dealing with the accusations against Kivlin, who ended up spending more than 2 months in jail over the allegations Schneider had made against him. It was during that time that investigators found proof that Schneider had faked emails and text messages from Kivlin to make it look like he had violated a no-contact order that she had against him in what they described as that sophisticated ruse. Now, a short time later, Bothell police also found she had fabricated emails and other evidence to back up her rape claim against Chief Milette. He was floored.
When I found out the extent that she went to in order to make it appear that I had a relationship with her and, you know, to demonstrate through evidence that I committed this crime, I quite frankly, I was shocked at the length that she went to basically frame me for something I didn't do.
Now, the entire case against Kivlin was dropped because of the fabrication of evidence that was found, and they basically prosecutors cited her Schneider's credibility. No charges were ever filed against Chief Milette, and he was officially cleared in late October. I asked him at the time what he thought should happen to his accuser.
I believe that people should be held accountable for their actions. And I think the accuser should be held accountable for her actions.
But he stressed that this was not about getting even.
I'm not seeking vengeance. That's not me. And again, I try to live my faith. And, you know, we're commanded to pray for those who persecute you. And I've been trying. I'm not perfect on things, but I'm working on it. But she should be held accountable. And that's not my decision to make. And, you know, I do believe that the right decision will be made.
The chief was still processing the news that charges had been filed against this woman when I spoke to him last night. Briefly, he was not ready to weigh in on this charging decision. Now, Schneider has a history of making false rape accusations as well. Back in 2008 and 2009, she'd done something similar. At the time, there were no charges filed against her because she had a mental health history, and prosecutors declined to do so then. So that's been the big question since all of this proof of fabricating evidence came out in these cases that we're talking about today, whether or not prosecutors were going to file charges. There was evidence from the investigators of both Bothell Police and the King County Sheriff's Department that looked into all of these cases that she had, there were grounds for perjury. She was not charged with perjury. She was charged with malicious prosecution, which is basically false reporting, and tampering with evidence, two counts each for Kivlin and Milette.
Now, you say these officers had met her on this website?
Uh-huh. Two of the officers, not Chief Milette. I want to be clear.
So okay, so they were on these websites?
Yep. Yeah, and they're dating websites.
Dating websites. I see. Uh-huh. Well, the one of them, what was it, a fetish? What was it?
That is a boat. I mean, it's a real site, but it's not one that Chief Milette was ever on.
So that part was fabricated.
Not the fact that that kind of a website exists, but the fact that he was on it and that they met. Yeah, she fabricated. There was all kinds of evidence fabricated. She gave some clothing she said had his DNA on it that didn't turn out to be true. She also looked at records of a rental home where he used to live with his wife and said that that's where the rape occurred, but that's not where Chief Milette and his wife, they had moved out of there months
later. So she was going through public records to try bring some credibility to the story.
And spoofing emails and spoofing text messages to make it look like these men had communicated with her when they had not.
Yikes. So there's really no good way to avoid a scam like this. I mean, you could just be basically chosen, targeted.
This is a rare case. Again, there are some mental health issues here, but it's been surprising to me that it was able to go this far when she had a history again in 08 and 09. It's not like nobody knew about this. She's been involuntarily committed once before, but she did have an ongoing relationship with John Kivlin, both of them whom were married, but they had an affair briefly, and then there was some domestic assault issues and stuff that went on in that. But there were some things that there was evidence to show that Officer Kivlin did do, but all of it ended up being dropped because of her credibility issues.
Kyra is Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Should you be making more money? I gather that the answer is yes after reading a report that was co-authored by Heidi Shierholz, who is the former chief economist of the U.S. Secretary of Labor during the Obama administration. And you work for the Economic Policy Institute now, and you were looking for reasons why, even with this low unemployment, people are still not being paid what they're worth when you look at the increased productivity. So what is the primary reason for that, Heidi?
I think a useful way to think of this is a low unemployment rate or tight labor markets, they shift bargaining power to workers. And the logic on that is totally straightforward. If your employer knows that you have a lot of outside options because the labor market is really strong, employers simply have to pay better wages to get and keep the workers that they need. So this question of, all right, we have really tight labor markets right now, why aren't we seeing stronger wage growth than they are? I think that has to do with the fact that yes, the tight labor market shifts economic leverage to workers, but the other things that shift economic leverage to workers have been totally decimated through policy choices over the last few decades. So things like policies to support unionization, policies to support stronger labor standards and their enforcement. In the late 90s, we had an unemployment rate that was not even quite as high as it is now, and we got much, much stronger wage growth. But we've had a couple of decades of really decimating union coverage and labor standards. So now, even at a 3.7% unemployment rate, we're not yet seeing really robust wage growth.
Can local governments take the place of unions by pushing, for example, for minimum wage laws, as happened here in Seattle?
I don't think it takes the place of unions, but it's definitely a really important companion. One of the things that raising the minimum wage can't do is have much effect on middle-class workers. The minimum wage really does hit, by definition, at the very low end of the wage distribution. So you're not getting that big chunk of people in the middle who have, over the last few decades, just not gotten their fair share of growth in this economy. Unions do that. Unions really help the middle class see their fair share of economic growth. And so you can get at some of the things unions do through labor standards, but it's not a substitute. We really do need a way for workers to come together and have a voice to get their fair share of the overall economic growth in the economy.
Is any of this because of the adoption of machines and just productivity tools, software tools, that are replacing these middle manager jobs?
I have devoted my whole career to sort of worrying about the labor market situation, labor market outcomes for low and middle income workers. And I am not worried about robots. I am not worried about machines. Those kinds of productivity enhancements that have happened since people started doing work. Since the very beginning, there was always innovation, always sort of quote unquote technological change where people could do work more efficiently. Mm-hmm. That's not what has caused the rising inequality in recent decades. And so I think that the robots are causing these problems is actually a diversion from what's really going on.
So you're saying that the reason wages are stagnating is not because of robots, and it's not because people don't want to be in unions. So Heidi, what level of annual wage increase should workers be expecting if they were being paid in terms of the worth of their work, the value of their work for the company, their productivity? What kind of annual wage increases should they be seeing at this point?
The answer to that is that the median worker, the typical worker, should be seeing wage growth of around 3.5% annually. If workers on average are getting around 3.5% growth per year, then we're seeing an economy where workers are sharing in the overall growth. Mm-hmm. And another thing to say is it's not like you just hit that for 1 year and then you're fine. Like right now, if we hit that for 1 year, it wouldn't even begin to make up for the years and years we've had of not even coming close to those levels. Mm-hmm. So the idea is get, you know, somewhere between 3% and 4% wage growth a year and sustain that, keep that going for a long time, and then we'll start to see more of the broadly shared prosperity.
So just doing this on the back of a napkin, if you're making $65,000 a year, you should be seeing a raise of about $2,000 each year.
Yes, that's a fair way to look at it.
Okay, so if somebody's not seeing that kind of raise, you need to go into the boss's office and point out that economic reports indicate I should be getting another $2,000 this year, and maybe they'll say yes.
That's good. And also the idea of, you know, joining together with your colleagues. If one person goes in against an employer, those odds are really difficult for that worker. But if you have if you
the whole office to go in
with your colleagues, it's a different story.
Yeah. All right. Well, if anybody tries that, please let us know how it works out. Heidi Scherholz is the former chief economist to the U.S. Secretary of Labor during the Obama administration, works for the Economic Policy Institute. Heidi, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
722, traffic in a moment. Few developments at the White House this morning to bring up to date on. The White House has instructed the Pentagon to begin planning for the immediate withdrawal of all 2,000 U.S. troops from Syria. President Trump has long wanted to do this. He declared that we have, in fact, defeated ISIS. That was the only reason that we were there. And so now they're coming home. Apparently, he had been prevented from doing this by the former Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Joseph Dunford, who opposed that. But now he has been replaced by General Mark Milley. Also, the president tweeting about the closing down of the Trump Foundation, a series of tweets this morning saying the Trump Foundation has done great work and given away lots of money over the years. I didn't take any fees, rents, salaries. Now, as usual, I'm getting slammed by Cuomo. That's a the governor of New York, and the Democrats in a long-running civil lawsuit started by sleazebag Attorney General, State Attorney General, Eric Schneiderman, who has since resigned over horrific women abuse. When I wanted to close the foundation so as not to be in conflict with politics, shady Eric was head of New Yorkers for Clinton and refused to even look at the corrupt Clinton Foundation. In any event, it goes on and on, and the new AG, who is now being replaced by yet another AG, who openly campaigned on a Get Trump agenda, does little else but rant, rave, and politic against me, will never be treated fairly by these people.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness Now, brought to you by Spring Free Trampoline. That's a song that could be playing as you roll up to 23620 Northeast 183rd Street in Woodinville. Now, every year for over 15 years, Mark Zembrowski transforms his home into a bedazzled light animation show that is fully choreographed with all of Mark's favorite holiday tunes that revelers can revel in as they walk the perimeter of the one-acre property.
Our visitors say that, you know, they get so much joy and happiness out of being able to come watch what I've created. Yeah, in many, many ways, the joy and everything like that is returned back on me because I've got a chance to be part of their lives at this time of year.
Mike says some Scrooges may scoff at all the time and money it takes to pull that display together, but for him, it's all about celebrating family, tradition, and sharing the spirit of Christmas.
There's a theme that we try to, you know, strive for, and that's, you know, creating memories and creating smiles. I've been able to see, you know, babies that were just bumps in bellies and, you know, watch them grow up over the years.
Thousands make the trek to Woodinville for this amazing display. And if it sounds tempting, don't wait until next year. This will be the last season as Mike and his wife Tracy turn their attention to building their retirement home in Chelan.
The difficult part of walking away is the fact that, you know, there's been many people that I've become their tradition with their families, that they would bring their kids year after year and I get a chance to see them grow up.
He says the display is free for all. His payment is the joy in seeing the wonderment in the smiling faces of both young and old. And for more information, you can check out WoodinvilleWonderland.com.
Time for the Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealer. Now here he is from that polar vortex of sports, 710 ESPN, Danny O'Neill. There's going to be a time when we're going to be packing Key Arena to watch the Seattle... Whatchamacallits, play NHL hockey. So,
what mascot do you want? What's the nickname you'd like? Are you impartial?
I am not big on mascots, actually. I would
what
like
was Cornell's Big Red?
It was a bear.
Really?
It was a big red bear.
A fearsome bear? A red bear?
It was a cuddly bear.
Really?
Ivy League bear.
Care Bear?
Not a bear that would actually attack anybody.
Okay.
Just a big, big chubby bear with a scarf around his neck. It sure scared the bejesus out of the other teams, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, yeah. So as we're packed to cheer on the Seattle whatchamacallums,
yeah,
what you want to know some lingo?
Yes, I do. I thought we'd go through the. Have you prepared something, or should I just go through the? I'm up to the O's and the P's now.
I've got a couple, but go ahead and ask me, and then I'll give you one at the end.
Okay, odd man rush.
Ooh, I believe that would be where you have a one man advantage. So it would be three attacking players moving forward with two defensive players between you and the net. And so you'd have a one-man advantage.
And that's legal. That's not icing.
Oh, yeah. No, that's just how it works out. You got a breakaway. You got numbers.
Dave, think about an interception in football. You turn over the puck, and you've got more guys going the other direction with the ball, in this case the puck. So then the other guy has a defender.
The coolest thing about hockey is the speed of the athletes on skates.
Yeah.
And having to turn around and stop their momentum once they get, if somebody loses the puck, that becomes a huge imperative because everybody goes from going full speed in one direction of the ice
to chasing after the puck
to having to redirect and get down to the other end.
By the way, remind me what icing is again.
Icing is when the puck travels across three lines. There's two blue lines and a red line.
You can't do that.
You can't just flick it from one end to the other. Because
so if you see a gap and you just want to score a quick goal from the other end of the ice, you can't just flick it into the goal.
If it goes into the goal, What you can't do is down in your own end, just take it and flick it the other way, because if the defense touches it first, it's icing.
Okay.
But if you get down there super fast and you're the team that flicked it down there, icing is waived.
Correct.
If the offensive person
that's like an onside kick.
Yeah.
What it prevents is from if you're defending in your half of the ice and deep in the corner, and you just say like, let's get this thing out of here, hot potato style, and we launch it to the other way. Well, that is not going to effectively end their possession. You don't just get the puck down there unless your guy touches it first.
Okay. Pepper pot.
Ooh. Would that just be where you start flicking shots at the goal?
No, that's a player with great speed and quickness.
Really?
We call him a pepper pot.
No kidding. Oh, I didn't know that one. That's fantastic.
You get that from Don Cherry in Canada?
Would you describe me as the pepper pot of the morning news?
I would describe you as many things, but pepper pot could be one of them. Yes.
I'm a little pepper pot coming in here at 7:47 each morning. What do you think a yard sale is, Dave?
Your little pepper pot. Yeah. Short and stuff.
Yeah, here's that's one. Exactly right. What do you think a yard sale?
That's a hockey term?
Yes.
A yard sale. I do not know. When you sell all your old hockey clothes?
No.
What?
Hockey clothes are involved.
Yeah. Like, was that when you're involved in a tussle and all your clothes get ripped off?
Yes. Similar. Or you are collided. Somebody collides with you and your equipment goes flying everywhere.
Like a car crash.
Yes. That's a complete yard sale.
It's called a yard sale.
He's had his gloves and helmet knocked off of him. Total yard sale.
Why isn't that called just roadkill?
No, yard sale is much more fun.
Yard sale.
Yeah,
okay.
All of a sudden he turned into a yard sale. We got his glove over there for $5. His helmet's over here for $3.
I see. Okay, playoff beard. No, I've seen that before. Poke checking.
Poke checking is where you use your stick to somewhat, it's not quite spearing, but you're using your stick to be able, spearing is when you take the butt of the stick and you give them the business, you know?
You can't do that, can you?
No, you can't. It's a penalty.
That's like targeting.
Yeah, that's worse than targeting because you're hitting them with a stick.
Poke check's a good one where you use your stick to slap at the other guy's stick who has the puck to kind of get his,
oh, like
make
forcing
him lose
a fumble.
Control.
Poke check.
Yeah, poke check.
Maybe that's the key here, is to translate these into football terms that I understand.
Well, that's great.
Which is also like, you know, translating from Swahili into Greek. But
yeah, that's fine, as long as you understand Greek.
Yeah.
Yeah, poke checking.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today.
Okay.
Is there anything
Pepper Pot's my favorite one.
Anything on the Seahawks we need to know about?
Yeah, Michael Dixon and Bobby Wagner are going to the Pro Bowl.
Yes.
And Russell Wilson got the shaft. He got Jared Goff's going to the Pro Bowl. Goff's got fewer touchdown passes, more interceptions. Jared Goff's been picked off more in the past three games than Russell has all year. But because he's in L.A. and because he plays for super genius Sean McVay, like, oh, he gets to go to the Pro Bowl and Russell Wilson's just an alternate.
Yeah. So you're saying Russell got poke checked.
He got poke checked.
Yeah.
Total yard sale.
Okay.
I'll tell you what, I'm a little pepper pot about it, too.
You sure are. Go out and spice up some stew.
All right. Sounds good.
Danny O'Neill. Our Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Some gun owners are concerned that the Trump administration, because of its ban on bump stocks, is actually coming for people's guns. And Emily Taylor is with a company called U.S. Law Shield, and you basically, Emily, provide an insurance backstop in case somebody who uses their firearm to defend themselves finds themselves in court?
Well, that's correct. The idea is that you shouldn't have to go broke if you have to defend yourself and then are arrested and charged criminally or later sued civilly by the bad guy or his estate or all of the things that can fall out. So what U.S. Law Shield does is make sure that law-abiding gun owners who exercise self-defense don't face financial consequences in addition to the other things that are looming ahead of them in that process.
And you're concerned that this ban on bump stock is basically an indication that the Trump administration is trying to disarm people?
Well, yes. In fact, this is something that I have never seen before. What we're doing here, by virtue of this new rule that the ATF intends to put into place, is disarm people of their property, of their bump stock, without compensation, without, frankly, I think the proper due process mechanisms. And we are taking things that they've bought with their hard-earned money without compensating them. And if you don't comply with this, right, at the end of the day, when you have to say, well, I have to be out several hundred dollars and give this property up, or if I choose not to comply, I'm going to be a felon. I face up to 10 years in prison and up to $250,000 in fines.
Well, but I think the reason for this is that the bump stock, for all practical purposes, turns a semi-automatic weapon into an automatic weapon, which would normally require a machine gun license.
Yes, but I totally disagree with that premise, because keep in mind that the ATF under the Obama administration actually looked at that same issue, and they said, because the definition of machine gun, of fully automatic weapon, is that by virtue of one pull of the trigger, multiple rounds of ammunition are expelled, that a bump stock doesn't qualify because it's the recoil of the rifle itself in order to sort of bounce your finger against the trigger, let the trigger reset so that you can pull more quickly. We're still talking about one pull of the trigger, one round of ammunition expelled. And if the Obama administration didn't think that this was a machine gun, you better believe that it is a huge stretch to decide that it is.
Well, I think the Obama administration just didn't want to fight that fight. But then the Las Vegas massacre happened and people said, there's really no difference here between a machine gun, which requires one pull of the trigger, and a bump stock, which simply jiggles your finger to accomplish the same thing.
But again, when we're talking about, not only when we're talking about constitutional rights, but when we're talking about how we promulgate our laws, mm-hmm. we can't kind of take that sort of broad sweep and say, well, but this thing is, it's kind of like a bad thing, and so let's make it unlawful. And if that's the choice we make, that's fine. Go to Congress, have them pass a law, and have the president sign it. That's how we fix this kind of issue, should it need to be fixed. So I think that our lawful answers have to be, Congress makes a law, and that law includes either a provision to grandfather in what's already out there to let you register it, perhaps, if that's the choice that they make, or to pay you what you paid for it. And quite frankly, there are only a 500,000 bump stocks out there in the country. This isn't, we're not talking about buying back, let's say, AR-15s here. There are not that many floating around.
When you say only a 500,000, that's 500,000 people who could potentially, I'm not saying they would do it, but would have the power to be able to shoot up a crowd in that way, which is a little bit disconcerting, don't you think?
Not at all, actually, because we all have, I mean, any of us who own weapons have the tool that could cause massive damage. However, we aren't inclined to do that because it's not the weapon that causes the bloodshed and the mayhem. It's the person. The bump stock, in fact, I mean, gosh, you know, it's going to make your shooting incredibly inaccurate.
Right.
It really isn't.
That's exactly the point. This is not a tool anybody would ever use for self-defense because it's wild. You'd only use it if you're going to, well, if you're, you know, having fun out on the open range, but also if you wanted to cause mayhem in a crowd.
But that cannot be, when we're talking about constitutional rights, it can't be the standard by which we live. You can't tell me that there are certain words that I shouldn't be able to say because there's no literary purpose to them, right? I mean, that's if the government told me that, that would be an incredible First Amendment violation. And even if you're not a gun person, if the Second Amendment goes, so will the rest. And it's a dangerous precedent to set.
But every right has a responsibility that goes along with it. So we give you the right to keep and bear arms, but that does not include hand grenade, does not include a bazooka, and does not include a machine gun now, unless you are properly registered with the required license, because those are considered weapons of war, not self-defense. And we don't want to get too much of those out there, even in trustworthy hands, because sometimes the bad guys tend to get a hold of them.
Well, so here I go making myself sound crazy on the radio again. But, you know, in fact, when you look at the Second Amendment and when you look at what the framers intended, they wanted the citizenry to have the exact same weapons that the government does.
When that weapon was a musket.
Oh, well, it was, but that was the assault weapon of its day. I mean, that's the machine gun, that's the AR,
For my money, you can have 200 million muskets in this country because you've got to reload that sucker between every shot. And so if you're a bad guy, we can bring you down pretty quickly with a pistol. But to give everybody a machine gun or a tank, I would at least want them to make sure that they were in the Army, had the training, and had a command and control structure so we weren't creating some kind of out-of-control military force.
Well, here is what, you know, I think.
Well regulated is in the Second Amendment. Remember that, right? Well regulated.
It is. It is, in fact. But the Supreme Court has not interpreted it in that way. And so we have to take, I think, what the framers intended and where their minds were at, look at what the Supreme Court precedent has said, and understand that we live in a world in which we've chosen to trust the individual. There are tools out there that, yes, can create massive carnage. You can figure out how to build a bomb on the internet.
Yes.
And you can build one, and guess what? The building of it is illegal. The possession of it is illegal. The murder you create with it is illegal. But people who have evil intent will still do it. And so what we need to do is, rather than criminalize pre-crime, which is not something this country ever wants to be in the business of, is we have to say, look, there are tools, you mentioned hand grenades, you mentioned tanks, if there are tools that the elected representatives have determined for legitimate purposes should not be in the hands of the citizenry, then those elected officials should pass a law. There should be an opportunity for the public to vote them out if they don't like it. Mm-hmm. And frankly, bump stocks are not well loved by most of the firearms community. I don't own one. I don't need one. If you regulate against them, you know, frankly, by all means, but do it the right way. Don't go through this back end that the Trump administration has chosen.
All right. That's clear enough. Emily Taylor is with U.S. Law Shield. Emily, pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Great to talk to you.